Let's say Owen and I are rookie students and we are about to enter into Sifu David Peterson's school. What would the first 2 or 3 weeks or a month be like of training, Sifu, as a rookie at your school?
Well, if we take the first lesson as a starting point, I have a kind of a rule in my mind that every time a student comes, basically our sessions go for around about 2 hours or more, depending on the day and whether people can hang around. But I essentially work on a two-hour platform. So every first lesson student, we try to cover five things. The first thing is to learn how to make the basic stance, the Ichikimyoma, the basic platform for Wing Chun, which I tell my students, there's only one stance in Wing Chun, and that's the Ichikimyoma. Everything else is a derivation or a modification of that stance. And that particular position needs to exist within every type of footwork that you do, or else you're not doing Wing Chun footwork. So we start them with the footwork. Once we've got the footwork, once we've got them in a stance, we introduce the basic punch. We start with a very big version of the punch, as in the beginning of the form, the long punch, which I explained to them, you're never going to use it in a fight, is to teach you a concept. In fact, a series of concepts, facing, center line, relaxation, keeping the body still, using the elbow, not the shoulder, and so on. Then we move on to reducing the punch down to its normal length. And then double punch, triple punch. And I usually don't go beyond three because it's not practical. You can't hit someone 10 times in a row. Because if you can hit someone 10 times in a row, your punch is crap. It means it's got no power. So unless he's tied to a chair or staked to a post, 10 punches in a row is a waste of time. So triple punch is the maximum that I teach anybody to do because it pushes you to try and go faster and get more coordination, but it's not unrealistic. You could hit someone three times if you got footwork with it as well. But one or two is going to be more likely. Then we teach them how to move in a forward direction. Wing Chun is an aggressive martial art. So the first steps you learn are attacking steps. Because you don't want to learn, I don't teach self-defense. That word is not in my dictionary. Right? Wing Chun doesn't believe in self-defense. It's an offensive martial art. It's like the military. Armies don't defend a country. They attack the enemy. The media calls it defending the nation. Actually, it's my army attacks your army, and we see who wins. So individuals do the same thing. If I'm standing there blocking your punches, defending myself, that means you're still winning because you're still attacking. What I need to do is reverse that situation as quickly as possible. So I need to be able to go forward and hit you. So I show my students first how to move forward. From the Ichikimyoma, we modify it into the basic stepping position, adding one punch at a time, then two punches at a time, and then multiple punches with multiple steps. Then we look at defensive footwork, what we call Toima. We start with the basic idea, which we work it around the idea of a clock. If there's a clock on the ground and you're in the center facing 12, for us in our family, we want to move either to the 5 o'clock or the 7 o'clock position. Anything wider gives my opponent time to chase me. Anything less means I'm still in front of the attack. So we try to always work in the 5 o'clock, 7 o'clock range. And then we do that on its own. Then we add a punch to that. Then we combine the two ideas of the footwork, get out the way and move in. So we're beginning to get the student's mind focused on the most important aspect of what Wing Chun is. The sooner I can get off the line and hit you, the better. I'm not just training you to be physically different in the way you respond. I'm trying to mentally program you to think differently. And that comes from those exercises. So that's already the form. There's the form, the stance. I'm getting to the form. It's in my head. This is the next thing to look at. The stance, the punch, forward steps, defensive steps, the combination of those two. And then finally, the first section of Sin Intel. Just the first section, the slow part, because it's easy to try to remember. It's not too difficult. So there's really only a few movements in it. It's not complicated. It's just repeating it to learn how to do it. And that would be your first lesson. If you came to my school, for 2 hours, you would be covering those five ideas. From then on, from the second lesson onwards, we put you in with the main group for as long as you can keep up with them, and we'll just add on to those things a little bit at a time. I'd advise you, do what you can. Don't try and worry about what you can't do. Stick to the things you know. We'll get to it, because usually during the class of that kind, partway through the class, generally within the first 30 minutes to an hour, I'll split the class up, give the seniors things to do. If there's another senior that can take care of them, I'll put that person in charge, and I'll take the beginners and build on what they've learned on that first lesson. And that'll proceed for a couple more lessons, and then we just throw you in the pool and get you to learn with everyone else. Because the best way to learn is from your peers. Yeah. Just like you want to be a good tennis player, go play with an expert. You'll be beaten a lot, but you'll learn a lot by being beaten. Right? If you want to be good at anything, you've got to get out there and try it against the best. So I'll bring you into the class as soon as I can, and we try to do a lot of interactive drills. It's not all individual techniques. It's a lot of interactive partner drills. And Wing Chun has a few classic ones like Pak Sao, like Chi Sao, like Lap Sao, and so forth. But also there are other things we can do, like I want to teach a person how to use the Wu Sao and the punch with their footwork. We can easily set up a drill for that and repeat it a few dozen times so they can feel the energy, because this is why I don't do video classes. I have a rule of thumb. If I can't touch you, I can't teach you. Right? You need to feel Wing Chun. You can't capture it in a photograph, and you can't capture it in a moving picture either, because you can't feel the energies that are involved. So the sooner I can get you working with a partner, the sooner you'll start to understand what Wing Chun is, because the pressure is what teaches you what to do. So I know that's a bit of a long-winded explanation, but in a nutshell, that's pretty much how I'd go about showing you how to do it. So within 2 to 3 months, you'd already be with the main group doing lots and lots of drills and things and working your way through the higher levels of training.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And intense. And thank you for giving the audience a little sneak peek of what it might be like to come say hello sometime.
Yeah. I had sort of a follow up question around that, concerning like, Wing Chun weapons. Like when would you introduce weapons? Like, I know that different lineages sort of introduce it at different times, but I was wondering, you know, when you think that that's appropriate.
As far as the pole is concerned, the Luk Tim Pun Guan, the 6.5-point pole, I don't make the students wait too long to learn that, because it has benefits in that it's building up strength in the wrists, increasing your punching power. Mm-hmm. It helps with your stance. It's actually overall quite beneficial to your long-term development. So we don't make the students wait too long for that, but I wouldn't introduce it in the first couple of months, because that would be too soon. They're having enough trouble understanding something as basic as a normal step and punch. Yeah. But within the first year, maybe a year and a half, I would already have some of the newer students already doing some of the basic actions of the pole, simply because I believe it's beneficial to them. But the Batamdo, the 8/9 form, or what people often call the butterfly knives, but that's an incorrect term, but I know it's commonly used. The Batamdo, we don't introduce that until way, way down the track. And it's not because it's a secret. It's not because it's some very special idea that can't be shared. It's because the Batamdo, like the Biltie form, contradicts a great deal of the basic rules. When I say rules, I mean guidelines of Wong Sun and Wing Chun. I'm speaking on behalf of my family system, not others, because I know there'll be disagreement. Other people have a different attitude.
Sure.
But as far as Wong Sun and Wing Chun's concerned, the Batamdo form, and as I said, the Biltie form, have ideas that totally contradict what you've been told to do and to not do within your basic training around what is contained in Sinin Tao, Cham Kil, and at least the first half of the Muk Yan Dong, the wooden dummy. Mm-hmm. So if a student is struggling to understand the basic principles and techniques of the system, and then you suddenly hit them very early with a whole lot of contradictions to what they're being shown, you just got to mess them up.
Yep.
So it's very important with the Batamdo that the student has a very good grasp of the basic concepts and skills of Wing Chun before they tackle the knives, because otherwise it's going to totally screw up their understanding. Mm-hmm. And the thing about a weapon is it adds an entirely new dimension to what you've learned. You're no longer striking with your fist or your palm. you've got something ahead of you. If it's the knives, it's at least a forearm length longer than your arm. If it's the pole, it's 9 foot long. Right? Yeah. It's much greater than your arm reach. So the concept of distance, timing, strategy, it's all different. So if you haven't grasped how to use your empty hands against a person who's also empty-handed, how the heck can you judge the difference with a weapon in your hand? How can you understand differences in the concept? And just as a sort of small digression, with Bilgi, it's the same thing. All the way through your basic training, we're taught don't cross your hands, don't use force, don't grab, don't bend your body, don't do this, don't do that. They're all dangerous things to do. In Bilgi, you contradict every single one of those. So how does a student who's new understand, why am I doing it this way when you told me not to do it that way? So if you start them on things like Bilgi and the Bajam Dol too early, confusion reigns havoc. But at least with the wooden dummy and with the pole form, the ideas are so similar that there's less chance of confusion. They can see the connection with those much more readily than they can with the other two. So that's basically my approach. And again, that's my Sifu's approach. Just to mention this because it's sort of on topic, Grandmaster Yip Man originally used to teach the forms in the order of Sin Yun Tao form, Cham Kiel form, Bilgi form, wooden dummy. My Sifu disagreed with that, and he had lots and lots of discussions with Yip Man because he felt you should teach Sin Yun Tao, Cham Kiel, then at least half of the wooden dummy before you start the student on Bilgi. His thinking was the concepts in Bilgi are very different from the concepts in the other forms, but the concepts in the first half, that what he used to call the first 60 or thereabouts movements in the wooden dummy, are pretty much the same, except the dummy is also showing you how to correct minor errors, simple mistakes that everybody makes that are not going to cost you the whole fight. So he believed that if you learn Sin Yun Tao, Cham Kiel, and at least half the dummy, and then went on to Bilgi, you would appreciate Bilgi better because you have a better understanding of what it's trying to show you, which is things outside the normal sphere of movement. And so eventually Yip Man changed. He actually started teaching it in the other order because he realized Wong Shen Lan had a good point.
That's awesome. And thank you for that story. That's a great insight.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really neat because it shows that even, you know, Yip Man himself was still, you know, he was thinking about how he was teaching and he was evolving.
Yeah. I think that's why my Sifu was like he was, because I think Yip Man was very much always trying to find a better way to do things. Mm-hmm. And that's why the first night I met my Sifu in November of 1983, he said to me, and I quote, "If you can show me a better way of doing what I'm doing, I'll learn from you." And the moment those words came out of his mouth, in Mandarin, of course, at the time, not in English, I realized I'd found my Sifu. Because most other Sifus would say, you know, it's my way or the highway. You do what I do or you don't do anything. He was a guy that was a legend, a living legend when I met him. And he was telling me if I could show him a better way, he'd switch over to my way. So I knew straight away, this guy is a genius. I want to learn from him. And I believe he got that attitude from Yip Man. And that's why I think probably Yip Man loved him the way he did. In Hong Kong, they describe Wong Shen Lung as, they call it Ye Wen Zui Ai De Tu Di, which translates as Yip Man's most beloved student. And the reason he was so beloved was because Wong Shen Lung challenged Yip Man all the time and questioned. The others all said, yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, and just followed what they were told. And Yip Man always told them, don't believe everything I say. I might be lying. Sifu never believed what he said. He checked him out and he told me the same thing. But he modified what Yip Man said to him when he said it to me. He said, don't immediately assume what I'm telling you is wrong. Test it, prove it's wrong or prove it's right, and then we'll discuss it. So those two little gems stayed with me until this very day. And that's what motivates me, one of the things at least that motivates me to keep pushing the legacy, to make sure it's still out there, because he had so much of value to share. So I'm just trying to transmit that as much as I can.
Can you think of maybe a fun, if you'd be willing to share with us in the audience, maybe a fun anecdotal story of Wong Shun Lian, something you look back on and kind of chuckle at? Well,
something that pops into my head immediately is the first time my people visited me in Melbourne was 1986, I believe. Or was it? Yeah, 85, 86, somewhere in there. I can't exactly remember the. I remember the venues that we went to and everything, but the year escapes me. But it was around end of 85, beginning of 86. He had gotten off the plane and he was extremely tired. He didn't travel well. He didn't like traveling in planes too much and he was feeling rather sleepy. So I suggested that he could sleep upstairs. At that time, my then wife and I had a townhouse in the suburb outside of Melbourne, and the upstairs was nice and quiet. And we could darken the room very well and he could have a good rest. But the plan was that evening we were going to take him into the city to meet the students and to run the first class that he was going to run for the students in Melbourne. And he was quite happy to do that, but he was really tired. And I said, well, let's get you rested first. So we took him upstairs, let him get settled in the bed, and he was asleep very, very quickly because he was really tired from the journey. He probably was up there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. There was a bit of snoring going on, so I knew he was having a good sleep. But it was getting close to the time that we needed to leave because, as in most big cities, there's peak hour traffic to deal with and you don't want to leave too late or else you won't get to your destination. So without knowing anything about him and his sleeping habits and his background, which become relevant in a moment, I walked in, leaned over, tapped him on the shoulder. Zivo, time to get up. And he turned with a startled look in his eye. And the moment he looked into my eyes, I saw my life flashing in front of my face.
Oh, no.
The look of, you're about to die. And then it was like, it's me, Zivo, it's David, time to get up. And all of a sudden he realized where he was and he sort of, his eyes darted around to realize he was in the room. He wasn't in a fight. And I was like, oh, okay. And he got up. Later on, when he finally came downstairs, he had a big grin on his face. And I said, is everything okay? And he said, yeah. He said, I guess I should have told you. It's probably best not to wake me up so suddenly like that, because I've always had a problem since my Baymore days when I was fighting. Even my mother used to throw socks at me from the doorway to wake me up because I had a habit of jumping up and hitting people. He said, I'm kind of on a hair trigger. It's just part of who I am. So I never, ever woke him up the same way again because of that.
That's a great one. That's a great story. In your journeys, what took you to Malaysia? Was it students that wanted to learn from you that brought you over? How did your Australian journey take a turn to Malaysia, my friend?
Very simple. Love. I met my now current wife, my love of my life, the partner I should have found a long time ago, but it took a couple of attempts to get the right one. And, she had a very, and still has a very successful career here in Malaysia. She's a very much loved, gynecologist and obstetrician in Malaysia. Half of the babies in the town that we live in are probably delivered by her. I was getting to the point in my career in Australia where life was just starting to suck. You weren't able to just be a teacher and go into the classroom and enjoy the subject that you taught, which for me was Chinese. You had to be a bookkeeper, a childminder, a sports teacher, and all these other silly administrative things that took away from the passion of being a teacher. And after 31 years in the job, I just about had enough and I was trying to find what else could I do. And I'd always had this belief that I didn't want my passion or my hobby to become my profession because I didn't want to hate my profession. Everybody has a job they have to do. I was a school teacher. You guys have your particular professions. You do it because you know you have to do it. You've got to put bread on the table and you've got to survive. But we don't always love our job. Some days you wake up and go, oh, not again. But you go anyway because you have to. And then you have your hobbies or your passions. And those are the things you do outside of work and you love them. And for me, that was Wing Chun. So my passion, everyone used to say to me over the years, oh, you love Wing Chun so much, why don't you teach it professionally? And I'd always say, no, I don't want to hate my job. I don't want to learn to despise what I do. So I'm going to keep it as my hobby. But then with life sort of turning a bad corner, my second marriage had failed and I was in a bit of a dark place, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. I met all of a sudden my current wife, and the opportunity was there. Instead of dragging her to Australia and forcing her to relocate and reestablish her career, why don't I go to Malaysia and see if I can find a way to reestablish my own life over there? And what can I do? Well, I was sick of teaching in a classroom in terms of teaching language. I didn't want to just reverse the role and become an English teacher in Malaysia. So the solution was simple, teach Wing Chun. And it sort of happened in a series of episodes. I was visiting Malaysia for a little visit each now and then to catch up with my then fiance. And word got out that I was in Malaysia. And I saw posts coming up on particular forums at the time. Remember the days when everybody posted on forums? They're just about dead now. It's all Facebook and Instagram. But once upon a time, everybody was on the Kung Fu forums. And I saw all these comments. Oh, does anybody know why Wong Sun Leung student David Peterson keeps coming to Malaysia? And I spotted one of these comments. So being a cheeky person that I am, I jumped on and said, hi, guys, this is David Peterson. Actually, the reason I'm coming to Malaysia is to visit a friend. If you're interested in getting together and discussing Wing Chun, I'd be happy to meet up on my next visit. What do you say? And a couple of guys jumped on the opportunity and said, yeah, we'll meet you, we'll meet you. And so on my very next visit, we arranged a meeting and I sat down with a couple of guys, one of them being my student, John Depp, not the movie star, a different John Depp. And John is now my right-hand man. He's my number two boy in the school. And he's an amazing fella. He's a former journalist and photographer. He's a brilliant artist. He's a magician. And he now currently runs a full-time coffee bistro in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. And our school is upstairs from the coffee shop. So we've got the best of both worlds, good food, good coffee, and kung fu.
That's so awesome.
So that meeting led to more meetings. Every time I'd come across, they eventually said, well, let's gather a few people together and why don't we do a little workshop? So the first workshop was at the school that John was then running. He had a little group of students and he was running classes a couple of times a week. So the first one, I think there was a dozen people came along and they had a great time and were raving about it. So the next time I came over, there's about 25. And the next time I came over, they'd arranged a full-blown seminar in a hotel complex in one of the areas just outside of the city of Kuala Lumpur. And we had about, I think it was about 80 people turn up from all over Malaysia.
Wow.
And so basically by the time I got to Malaysia full-time at the beginning of 2011, John handed over the keys to his school and said, Sifu, it's all yours. So I had an instant school and an instant group of students and an instant new career. And it just went from there.
Good for you.
That's a fantastic story. That's awesome.
And I'm still very, very much in love and very happy with my wife, who's still with me and supports me every step of the way. So life is good. Except
even better.
COVID kicked us all in the guts. I had to shut the doors of the school for 23 months, but the bills were still there. Still had to pay the rents and the power and the water and everything else and all the other things that had to be paid for. So I had to tap into my retirement fund, and I now have a zero bank account and a great deal of credit debt, and the students didn't all come back. We've lost about 85% of the students, so things are a bit tough at the moment. Hopefully they'll pick up, but at the moment things are a little bit difficult. In Seremban School, which is the big school, on an average class, the numbers used to be 15 to 25 people a lesson. It's 3 or 4 or 5 now, so it's not easy. Thankfully, in Kuala Lumpur, which has a bigger population, we're getting slightly more numbers than that, but still it's not like it used to be. But, yeah, fingers crossed and prayers being sent upwards, things will improve.
We'll send you all the good energy, Sifu. So
yeah, that would lot. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I know we don't want to take up too much of your time because I know you got class starting soon and I don't know how to, this one's going to be a big one. And you can drop as many F-bombs as you like. You were a guest on our show and we drop as many as we like as well. This is one that I've really, thought about for a while, and getting someone that's been a part of the Wing Chun community for so long and seen quite a bit of it. You started the show talking about this next generation. We'll call it the entitlement generation of Wing Chun. What are some of the things that might frustrate, frighten you, or upset you with this, the way that Wing Chun is progressing? What do you think we could, you know, can be done to right that ship? But what are some of those things? If you got on the soapbox and said, what are we doing to Wing Chun? What do you think that would be, Sifu?
I know from past experiences, one of the issues is that whenever any of us oldies say something, we usually get jumped on very heavily by all the people who believe in the newbies. They're like a cult, and they have a cult following. And because they're willing to say that they know better, a lot of people of their thinking support their beliefs and what they say. So what usually happens is us oldies from the first generation get called out as being the bad guys, or you're trying to repress us, you're trying to take away our ambitions and our creativity. You're stuck in the old ways. You don't understand. Things have to change. And they often quote things like, you know, look at MMA. MMA is the product of changing things for the better. Well, what they really don't realize is, and this is no reflection on MMA, and I have nothing against MMA per se, but the big picture that they're all missing is there isn't a single thing in MMA that isn't derived from traditional martial arts. So you can't say MMA is better than traditional martial arts because it wouldn't exist without traditional martial arts.
Amen.
That's the first issue. The second thing is they say, oh, there's too much emphasis on forms and classical ideas, not enough emphasis on fighting. That's like saying, give a 5-year-old a Ferrari and say, go down the racetrack and go for your life. Or give a 4-year-old a scalpel and say, get in there and do that operation. You have to go through a process of learning before you're ready to perform on the racetrack or in the operating theater. There's a process. And too many of this generation are trying to shortcut the process. They want to do it all in a few weeks and open a chain of schools last week. They want to have fame and fortune without doing the work. You can't do it that way. And if they ever try to put themselves to the test, they usually end up flat on their back. Now, they'll very quickly say that, oh, look at all these classical martial artists that are getting knocked out by all these modern martial artists in the ring. Look very closely. Who are most of those so-called classical martial artists that are getting knocked out? They're nobodies. They're guys that trained 10 years ago, 20 years ago. They're not people currently in training. They're people who've never been hit before. They choose their targets very well, these guys that put up these videos. They choose people who don't know how to fight, and then they beat them up. They don't step into the schools of people with a good reputation for fighting and challenge them. Now, I'm not trying to create a stir here or call anybody out for a fight. I'm 67 years old. I don't really want to get into the ring and have a fight with anybody. But my point is, if you want to be good at the job of teaching any kind of martial art, doesn't matter what system, what family, what style, you need to put in the time and the effort. And that's missing from the current generation of practitioners, very largely missing. And that means that what the current learners are getting is a watered down, incomplete and untested version of the system, which then if they try to pass it on, following in the same footsteps as their teachers, it becomes even more diluted and more watered down and less effective than what they were given. And it's a little bit like the Chinese whispers. I tell you a story and you tell your friend and he tells his friend. And by the time it does the rounds and it comes back to you, completely different story. Because if you didn't hear the story properly the first time, you're going to repeat it wrongly and with your own embellishments. If you don't learn a martial art properly, you're going to repeat it wrongly and with your own embellishments. This is what's wrong with a lot of so-called Ip Man Wing Chun. Ip Man, God bless him, wasn't always careful about who he showed things to. He had a reputation of being known as Dak Suk. Dak Suk in Cantonese translates as Uncle OK. If Ip Man didn't really care for you too much, if he didn't really think you were that smart or really motivated, he wouldn't spend a great deal of time with you. He'd leave you with the other instructors and let you play with them. And what would happen is people would be training and they say, Sifu, Sifu, Tam Daka, is it okay, Sifu? Am I doing it right? And he would just look across and go, Datla, which means okay. He wouldn't correct them. And so he got this reputation of being Uncle Okay. And so these guys thought he was saying, yeah, you're good. I agree with what you're doing. What he was really doing was dismissing them because he didn't really consider they were going to last very long. Time goes by. Ip Man's passed away. The Kung Fu boom is here. Everybody now wants to learn martial arts. And a lot of these guys now middle-aged haven't trained since the 50s or the early 60s, haven't even picked up a pole or a knife in all that time, suddenly see, wow, easy money teaching Kung Fu. Let's open a school. And what happens? They start teaching their vague recollection of what they didn't learn properly 40, 50 years ago. And now we have a whole new generation of Ip Man Wing Chun that's total bullshit. It's got nothing to do with Ip Man's Wing Chun. They've deviated so far from the model that it's glaringly incorrect, but they think they're right. Because, oh, but he was a student of Ip Man, must be correct. Not all students learn the same amount of information. Not all students learn this for the same amount of time. Not all students put in the same amount of effort. You need to be very careful who you're learning from. My sifu proved that the first time he challenged Ip Man's school. He beat up two of the students easily with a bit of simple boxing. After that, Ip Man shut him down, and we all know the story. He joined the school. But there's always going to be those guys that say they've learnt properly, but they haven't. There's a person currently doing the rounds in Wing Chun, mostly in the European theatre. I'm not going to name names. People know who I'm talking about. He's basically telling everyone that he knows better than all those that were there doing the training in the day. He spent a few days here, a few weeks there, a few months perhaps elsewhere, visiting teachers who were there, taking photographs with them, watching mine and other people's DVDs and reading our books and articles and so on. And he's basically regurgitating what we do, but doing it in a much more robotic, very machine-like way. But because he's pushing himself as, how can I put it, the new messiah of Wing Chun. I've trained all these guys and I've been able to put together all the best of what they learned. So where this guy didn't get it all and that guy didn't get it all, I've got it all. And people are buying into this crap. And he's getting lots and lots of people following him, building up quite a big business for himself. But in the long term, what are those students actually getting? It's almost like pyramid selling. The guy who starts the business and the first few people who join are going to get rich. But all the people down the bottom are paying a lot of money, but what are they really getting out of it? And this is my big issue with modern Wing Chun, is that it's going down that path. It's all about the cult of personality, and I know better than the old guys. The old guys might be old guys, and we might not move as quick and as powerfully as we did before, but we learned it from the source. You weren't there. You didn't hear what was said. You didn't feel what was done. You didn't get on the receiving end of those techniques. How do you know? But I'm preaching to people that either don't want to listen Or there's a handful that are going, yeah, I understand. We know what you're saying, but what can we do?
Yeah.
It's kind of, we're stuck in the middle of a problem that we can't really fix. And like I said, the moment any of us say anything about these people, we look like the bad guys. And I went through a period of quite a hammering a few years ago where everyone was attacking David Peterson because I was sticking up for the traditional approach to training and all the values that that can bring to you. And I was being told that, you're old fashioned, go back into the corner. You're refusing to change. You're not moving with the times. I still firmly believe that what I do is going to give you the results you want. You just have to be patient enough to train it. Instant results come with a price. Under a certain amount of pressure, perhaps those instant results aren't going to work just as well as the old way. It's a bit like, what's the better one, traditional coffee or the instant kind? Instant one, you can get it straight away, but does it taste as good? The answer is probably not, unless all you know is instant coffee.
That's a great point.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, I like that.
Oh, and I've only got one more question for Sifu. How about yourself, my friend?
Go for it, man.
What's on the horizon, Sifu, besides getting students back to the school? What's next for Sifu David Peterson in your martial journey?
I think overall, just to continue what I'm doing for as long as I can, make sure that I get the message out as clearly as possible, leaving behind enough reference material so that when I'm no longer around, and of course my Sifu is no longer around, if people are curious about what was the Wong Chun Leung Wing Chun Kyun Ho approach, they've got some references from a source that was close to the source, as well as the original stuff that exists with my Sifu. So that if they're torn between who knows better, this guy who's just the new kid on the block, or this guy who actually learnt from Wong Chun Leung all those years ago, then they can go and actually have a look and see, or read and see, discover for themselves where the answers might lie. So I think my days of traveling around the world doing seminars and so forth, I think they've pretty much come to an end. I find traveling now is becoming very tiring. I tend to have to, because of, I need to be here for my students, I tend to fly to my whatever destination it is, get off the plane after 14 hours, 20 hours, 24 hours, teach for a couple of days, get back on the plane, fly all the way back, and then go straight back into the classroom. And it totally exhausts me. I understand why my Sifu said just probably a month or so before he passed away, he was asked by one of the other Wing Chun nephews in Hong Kong when he was seen on the street after the trip to Beijing. The guy asked him, how are you, Sifu? Oh, I'm so tired. They're making me do so many things. I'm so exhausted. I need a rest. And less than 2 months later, he suffered a stroke and died. Mm. So I'm now older than my Sifu was when he passed away, and you don't know what's around the corner. So I'm trying to preserve myself as much as I can. And so I'm telling people, it's better for you to come to Malaysia. The economy here is pretty low. So if you come over here, your money goes a long way. So it's better for you financially. It helps me because if you can pay me the fees that I'm asking, you're helping me build up my income and keep my school going. Mm-hmm. And it stops me from killing myself traveling. And especially now with COVID ever present, I've had COVID twice now, and I don't think third time would necessarily be a lucky one. So, and it's on the way back. In Malaysia, we've got rising numbers of COVID currently.
Yeah.
So we still insist people training with masks on and disinfect themselves as they train. And for all those reasons, and just generally just to make life a little bit more comfortable for myself, I think the best thing I can do is just keep producing the occasional article when I feel inspired to write something. I'm not a full-time writer for Eric's magazine anymore, but I'm thinking in occasionally of doing maybe an article here and there. Keep producing the little videos because they seem to be very well received. I probably had less than 1% negative comments. Everything's been glowingly appreciative of what I'm doing. So I think
it's phenomenal.
I think we're onto something. So again, Ronnie and Ho, thank you for pushing me to do that. And thanks to all my guys here in Malaysia who helped me do it week in and week out. We're going to be shooting again on Sunday, which is tomorrow for me, because we've just about emptied the barrel, so we need to top it up again. Mm. So I'm happy to keep doing that, keep teaching my students here to make sure the next generation is well-trained. And if anybody wants to come and learn, I only ask for three things: consistency, loyalty, and an effort. Make an effort. My Sifu said this, similar things when he was asked, why do you teach the foreigners? Because a lot of the teachers, when he was teaching foreign students, didn't teach foreigners still. They kept it very much only Chinese. And he said, doesn't matter whether the student is white, black, green, yellow, orange, or blue, if they're willing to train hard, stay loyal to what I'm teaching them, and pass it on in a pure form, why shouldn't I teach them? It's irrelevant what their race, religion, or beliefs are. If they believe in Wing Chun, that's good enough for me. That's my attitude too. I've been burned in the past. I'm very accepting of people. I tend to trust everybody, which is just my nature. It's turned out to be a mistake on a few occasions. I've been badly betrayed by a group of students in a couple of countries. But I went in with the thought that I'm going to give you everything I can give you because I believe in you. And I hope you'll do the same. So I just ask the same from anybody that comes to me now. But I also put a caveat on that. If you're coming here just to get a name for yourself, or to take my name or my Sifu's name, or to train for a week and then open up a chain of schools, don't waste your time. Don't waste my time. I'm not interested. If you're prepared to keep coming back at least semi-regularly and put in an effort, and go back and train like a crazy person, the way I used to train like a crazy person, you'll be welcome with open arms, and my students will love to help you and train with you, and we'll make you part of the family. So simple as that. So that's my mission, I guess, is to keep doing it for as long as I can do it. So as long as the legs work and the brain works, I'll keep doing it.
Amazing.
That's awesome. Fantastic.
Sifu, thank you for your time.
Yep.
It has truly been an honor. I've been a fan of yours since we had a college group back when I started college back in 1998, and we were one of the math professors was teaching the Wing Chun Club, and mm-hmm. I had the bug. It bit me, and you know, you were one of those names way back when, and so it's a little bit surreal for me to see you and listen to you and be, you know, not necessarily in the same room with you, but share some of your time. So thank you so much. This has been real honor. And we will let you know when the episode comes up. And thank you again, Sifu. And keep training and stay healthy, and good luck with the school.
Thank you very much. And I'll make sure my students get the message when it's out so they can all tune in and build up your numbers.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Thank you, Sifu. Have a blessed day.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. See you next time. Bye.
Yep. Bye-bye.